Hi, Erica Voles here. Welcome to the Law Report. In a time of conflict, defining what constitutes a cyber attack, a potential act of war, is tricky. So is international humanitarian law keeping up with the new battlefields of the 21st century? We're going to take a look at this later in the show. Actor Rebel Wilson made international headlines when she successfully sued Bauer Media because of defamatory articles they published about her. The court ordered the publisher pay up $4.5 million. That's still being played out in the courts, as are other cases involving high-profile Australian actors. But a new study suggests that the rich and famous are not your usual plaintiffs when it comes to defamation cases, nor are media companies the usual suspects when it comes to defending defamation claims. The study's author is Dr. Derek Wilding. He's the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney.
Well, we found that overall, over a period of 5 years, that 51% of our cases were digital defamation cases, as we call them. So that could involve publication in any kind of digital form. And what we found was people had been posting on Facebook. It involved emails, it involved tweets, text messages, and also quite a number of postings on blogs and websites that were not the websites of major media organisations, but were ordinary websites that people had set up or something other than what you'd call media.
So many people would assume that defamation cases are largely centred around high-profile figures who are in conflict with big media organisations. Is that the case today?
That's not really the case at all. We found 26% of these cases there was a major media organisation. So that's quite a lot of publications or publishers, if you like, that are not media. And on the people that are bringing the actions, only 21% of them could be regarded as public figures.
That's a real change, isn't it? That 4 out of 5 defamation cases are involving people who we would consider private individuals.
That's right. It's disputes between private individuals. It's disputes involving an individual and their employer. But it is less the case that it is public figures, celebrities and politicians bringing actions against media companies.
So let's talk about some of the cases that you looked at. One of the cases involved the CEO of a football company who felt that they had been defamed. What do we know about the facts of this case?
Yeah, that was a case from 2016 in the ACT, and the plaintiff was the CEO of the football company, and she brought an action against someone who it was said was a coach and a former player who'd posted statements about her on his Facebook page. This occurred over a period of time. There were 9 postings that were at issue in the case, and they were pretty forthright comments, including accusations of the CEO being fraudulent, dishonest, a liar, gender biased, etc. She brought an action against him saying that indeed they defamed her, that they caused her to question her reputation and her integrity, and that in fact it hastened her transition out of that job. In that case, it was Facebook postings, and his page was open. It was a public page. He had 400 friends. And what I think was one of the interesting aspects of that was that the judge, in describing what had happened, talked about publication in a way that I think is somewhat removed from what people would assume is involved in social media. So he said that the content was made available for publication by the defendant, and he permits and controls third-party comments and a response to the content that he posts. So that kind of comment is something that you might ordinarily think would be attributed, or the kind of conduct that you'd describe a media organisation being involved in, not necessarily an individual person who's posting on Facebook. And it shows that transition away from comments that are made in a personal environment to something for which you're going to have to answer in a legal sense.
Speaking as someone who works at the ABC, whenever you put something on a Facebook page as a producer or a presenter, you have to keep an eye on the comments that are coming through, and there's a responsibility to kind of filter. In a way, was the judge saying that having an open Facebook page also carried that kind of responsibility for a private individual talking about someone who was, you know, somewhat prominent in her community?
Yeah, I think that's right. There were various elements that were involved, particularly in reaching the decision on the damages that were awarded. but the open Facebook was one of those aspects. And another interesting part of the case was that this plaintiff might be said to be someone who had a particularly high reputation, so that this had a particular impact upon her.
You said that damages were awarded, so the court actually found that she was defamed. Tell us about the damages.
That's right. So the plaintiff in this case was awarded $180,000 in damages, but she also got injunctions to prevent the defendant from continuing to publish anything about her.
So not only you have to pay up, but you've got to stop making the defamatory comments.
That's right.
There was another recent case involving a defendant who sent a text message, and that saw them the matter of legal proceedings over defamation. Can you tell me about this case?
Well, that was a case of Birtwistle and Conquest, and it was a decision of the District Court in Queensland. And that involved text messages that were sent by Ms. Conquest on a day in 2014. They were just sent to her sister, and they accused the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Birtwistle, of, in the words of the court, having engaged in consensual and non-consensual sex with his sisters. So the claim was pretty serious, but it was only sent to one person and it was sent by text. This case was interesting because it, like the previous one, it involved a defendant who did not appear in court. So the matter proceeded and the plaintiff gave evidence about how he had been affected by this claim about him, what the court referred to as the grapevine effect through the family. He said that he no longer receives invitations to social functions and gatherings, and previously he had a good relationship with the family. So it had had this impact upon him. And in that case, the defendant offered a kind of apology, but not one that was sufficient for the purposes of defamation law. And she didn't appear at the time of the judgment, and she didn't appear at the time that the damages were being determined. So decision was entered against her. And in that case, damages of $100,000 were awarded. But also in this one, injunctions were issued against her.
You know, in this instance, it was one text message, but it wasn't so much the text message as the ripple effects.
Yeah, the grapevine effect. One of the interesting aspects of this is that people probably wouldn't assume that that kind of communication constitutes publication within the meaning of defamation law, sending a text to your sister. But in fact, once you say something and make that statement to someone other than the plaintiff, you are engaging in publication, and this constituted publication. And so the defendant here was liable for her comments about the plaintiff.
Did this surprise you that one text message would be considered publication?
It does surprise me. It seems to me that it's an aspect of our current environment that certainly wasn't anticipated some time ago when the principles that were involved here were formulated. I guess the law has evolved over time and tries to apply principles in a consistent way so that they're technology neutral, that every new technology doesn't mean upending the system. But at the same time, I think, you know, we'd have to say that the circumstances of publication have changed so profoundly over the last 15 years or so that these forms of communication are just something that is wholly new, and applying the law that we've developed for quite different circumstances, including for, say, publication in mainstream media, is not necessarily the kind of approach that we want for publication in a contemporary environment.
In both of these cases, the defendants, I believe, didn't show up. But if they had shown up and they'd been able to prove the truth of any of the allegations in the two cases, then they could have mounted a defence, couldn't they?
Yes, they could have. After getting over the phase in which the defamatory meaning of the matter is established, by choosing not to defend the matter, of course, they open themselves up to judgment against them, and essentially for the imputations to be accepted on their face without being challenged.
Does it also show that ordinary individuals might be a bit caught out by all of this?
I think it certainly shows that that people who use social media, for example, are not expecting to be brought into court as a result of comments that they make about people on their Facebook page or in text messages they send or something of that kind. Whether we ought to all be so blasé about statements that we make about people is a reasonable question, but I think it's certainly the case that most of us wouldn't anticipate that we would potentially be caught up in legal action, and in some cases maybe caught up in legal action that goes on for a long period of time and is very costly.
Dr. Derek Wilding, do you feel that our laws have kept up with the changes that our society has gone through, given that everyone now has the power to be a publisher?
Look, I think it's definitely the time to reassess whether the law is actually appropriately dealing with the forms of publication that we have today. It's always been the case that media organisations have faced significant challenges in publishing, that defamation laws to some extent have been a chill upon what can be said on free speech within this country. We have particularly strong defamation laws. But I think what we see now is that those laws are having their application to everyday people, to the kinds of statements that we all might make on social media. And while we do need to exercise some personal responsibility for that, it's one thing to have laws that are designed for mainstream media. It's another to apply those same laws in circumstances where many of us now have opportunities to publish, to make our views known in ways that we didn't some years ago.
And look, we've been talking about some big payouts, you know, 100,000 and more. Is that the norm in the cases that you've reviewed?
Well, that's the odd thing about defamation damages. We hear about large payouts. We've discussed some that are in the region of 100,000 to 200,000. There have been some spectacularly high payouts just in the last year. For example, in the Rebel Wilson case in her matter against Bauer Media. But at the same time, that's not always the case. That in fact, when you look at the damages that have been awarded over the last 5 years, you see that in some cases the damages are as low as $5,000 or $2,000. In 1 year, in 2015, we found that 21 awards of damages that were under $100,000. So it is often the case that having gone through quite a degree of preparation, a lot of cost and time to mount a defamation action, the rewards, in terms of the financial rewards at least, are not necessarily that great, and they're certainly not the kind of result that is obtained or that we read about in high-profile cases like the Rebel Wilson case.
How often were plaintiffs, so people who felt that they had been defamed, how often were plaintiffs actually successful in proving in the courts that, yes, they had been defamed?
Well, we were surprised to find that plaintiffs were successful in only about 35% of the cases that we studied. So I guess contrary to expectations about the potential payout, plaintiffs didn't always win. They were sometimes subjected to lengthy court processes, and at the end of that, they didn't win that case. So in that sense, it's not a terribly satisfactory approach for a plaintiff to launch a defamation action, it would seem. Further, if the damages that you receive, having gone through all of this, are as low as $5,000 or $2,000, then clearly you're not even going to cover your costs. And I think that's probably something that people need to take into account when they're considering their options and whether, in fact, legal action is really something that is going to be in their long-term interests. The idea of disputes between individuals over social media posts being solved by legal action is not something that should have great appeal to individuals, and it's certainly not something that that has much appeal in terms of promoting free discussion within the community.
So dare I say, this is an avenue that could benefit from a bit of mediation or alternative dispute resolution?
Yeah, I think definitely it's a case of opportunities for people to make amends, to maybe take the approach that's taken in the media, where the kind of intervention of something like a clarification, a correction, an apology, in reasonably formal terms, but in something that's meaningful, can actually have that effect of addressing someone's concerns and doesn't lead to a claim for some kind of financial compensation that may well not be successful anyway.
So, Dr. Derek Wilding, some people will be listening to this conversation with their thumbs hovering over their phones as we speak. What's your advice to people who might be prone to letting off a bit of steam online, on Facebook or on Twitter or in other forums? What's your advice to them about how to avoid defaming people?
Well, I think under the laws that we have at the moment, everyone needs to think twice about the kinds of statements that might be made about people in a social media environment or in text or in email or in on blogs, because what most of us don't assume to be the case is that our actions make us publishers in the same way, really, that major media organisations are publishers. So we're subject to the same laws, and potentially we can be involved in quite serious defamation actions that might be costly and time-consuming. What this study and what some of these cases show is that there's a real tension here, that there are some cases where people have had very serious accusations made against them on social media and in other forms of digital publication, and there does need to be some potential remedy for that. On the other hand, there's a series of matters that do not reach the kind of threshold that we would imagine would be subject to defamation law. And so what's needed here is some kind of test. Those cases that should be part of addressed via the legal system and those that should be addressed some other way.
Dr. Derek Wilding, the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at UTS. We've put a link to the study on our homepage. Makes for interesting reading. Just head to the RN website and select Law Report from the drop-down menu. On RN, Radio Australia, News Radio, and on your smart device, this is The Law Report. I'm Erica Vowles. You're listening to an augmented reality app called Enter the Room. It's by the International Committee of the Red Cross. It's just launched. It gives a child's viewpoint on living in a war zone. The Syrian conflict is now in its eighth year. Since 2011, more than 350,000 people have been killed and millions have been displaced. So amid the death, destruction and lawlessness, what role does international humanitarian law play? Pavel Shishek heads up the Communications and Law Program for the ICRC in Syria. He's just returned from their mission to provide essential aid to the besieged region of Eastern Ghouta near Damascus.
The needs are very dire and the situation has been very difficult, not only for the people of Eastern Ghouta, but for thousands of others who are still affected by the violence, including, for instance, the people living in Damascus city who are exposed to indiscriminate mortar shelling, you know, as a result of what is happening on the outskirts of Damascus in Eastern Ghouta.
And Pavel Shishek, when I watch those videos that so many Syrian children seem to make, pleading to camera, to the international community for help when their houses are being bombed or when their family members are killed. I can only imagine to them that concepts like international humanitarian law must seem completely irrelevant. When you're on the ground in those situations, how do you grapple with this, the stark contrast between the ideals of international humanitarian law and the reality on the ground, where it provides, you know, no protection?
You're right, and I think here we really come into the very, very important point of what is the international humanitarian law and who really is the utmost concerned about the international humanitarian law, because it's the ICRC as much as we are, let's say, the guardian of this law or the organization whose mission is to promote the principles of it. We cannot really impose this law on the fighting parties. We cannot really force them to implement it. At the end of the day, it's up to the fighting sides to really, and I'm talking here about both sides or multiple sides, let's say, in this conflict, to try to bring a little bit of humanity into the modern warfare. I would like to ask here the question, I mean, what would happen if we did not have this basic framework of humanity in the war times? What would happen if we wouldn't set out the limits on how the war should be conducted? Because, of course, we cannot really force on the sides to respect the IHL, but we can engage in a dialogue and try to understand it. But we still believe that there must be the rules. There must be this ethical, moral, and legal framework to protect people in the times of the fierce battles. Because if we don't have these rules, where would we arrive?
And one issue in Syria which is having an increasing impact is the notion of cyber warfare. How is cyber warfare having an impact, and how is that impact being felt on civilians?
Today in Syria, we see the conflict being conducted not only on the ground, but also in the cyber sphere, a kind of parallel war, parallel conflict being really led, you know, online in the digital sphere. And you have the cyber armies, you know, hacking each other, and you have a trolling activities, and you have this kind of media war. I mean, and then you have, you know, a different information info war that is being constantly conducted, and then of course you have the different, you know, hacking that is being employed out there in support of one side or another, and this totally changes the face of war, because today it goes beyond who is winning the information war on the about the conflict in Syria. The risk of that is also, you know, of what kind of essential infrastructure website is being hacked, or what kind of service could be disabled as a result of this kind of cyber activities. This is one of the sphere that I would expect to escalate way further as the world conflicts progress.
Pavel Shishik with the ICRC, speaking via Skype from Damascus. How to deal with conflicts as they increasingly enter the cyber realm is one of the issues exercising the minds of international law experts. So is the Geneva Convention and the international humanitarian laws it governs still fit for purpose when the battlefront is increasingly in cyberspace? Ellen Polosinski is a leading global expert on the laws of war from the ICRC, and she's managing editor of the International Review of the Red Cross.
The rules were written in 1949, and so a lot of times people will say that they were written for another time. The rules are designed to govern sort of the unpredictable, so there's flexibility there. Under Article 36 of the First Additional Protocol, there is provision for new weapons. It states that new weapons should be tested to ensure that they're capable of complying with the rules of international humanitarian law, and that would cover all new weapons, including cyber weapons. How that works in practice is complicated, and I think with the development of cyber warfare and cyber weapons, there are a lot of questions that are being asked. But in general, the problems with IHL are in terms of compliance, not in terms of the rules being adequate.
So when we're talking about cyber warfare, can you give me some examples of what we would define as cyber warfare?
Inside of a conflict where cyber means and methods are used, it's easy where there's a pre-existing armed conflict to say that IHL should govern those operations. Where there's not a pre-existing conflict, it can become more complicated to determine whether a cyber attack would trigger an armed conflict. And there, this is an issue that's very closely related to IHL, because in order for international humanitarian law to apply, there has to be an armed conflict. The important thing to look at is not the weapon, but the harm that it causes. Where it could be complicated is in cyberspace, where in a way a lot of the nature of the internet is that it's dual use in a lot of places, where it's used for both civilian and military purposes. And there's a lot of unanswered questions in this area that really we need more clarity on. I think ultimately that will come down to states clarifying their practice and also on letting us know how they're interpreting the law in this area.
It's hard to grasp these things when we're talking in the abstract. Can you give me an example, perhaps even in the hypothetical, of a cyber attack that might come under the Geneva Convention?
We could imagine that there might be a cyber attack in conflict that could take down a power grid, for example. And there you'd need to look at the harm that would cause to the civilian population, and you'd need to consider the effects, even the indirect effects that would cause, in order to evaluate the proportionality. So you'd have to look at what cutting the power supply would do to hospitals and also to, let's say, the water supply potentially, because especially in urban areas, the essential services tend to be quite interconnected.
So in some respects, it's not that different to the way we might assess the impact on civilians of taking out a bridge or a power station. It's just the means of attack is different.
Yes, exactly.
So, Ellen Policinski, some have called for a digital Geneva Convention, so new laws of war to deal with war in the digital realm.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea to have a digital Geneva Convention. I think here it's important to think about what that would cover, because some are calling for this convention to cover activities that would also be carried out in peacetime. And that's not a bad thing. Anytime that there's more protection in cyberspace, that's great for everyone. What the ICRC is specifically focused on would be these types of attacks in armed conflict. And so there, what we know does apply is the current rules of IHL and the conduct of hostilities. I think there's room to clarify as they would relate to cyber and to fine-tune the interpretation of those rules. But I think what's most important to note is that rules of conduct of hostilities, of distinction, proportionality, and precautions still do apply to those attacks. And really what's important to evaluate is the effect of the attacks.
One example which is cited as an example of a potential cyber attack was the Stuxnet attack on Iran's nuclear centrifuges. Can you tell us a little bit about this and some of the interesting, I guess, issues it throws up in terms of digital warfare?
The Stuxnet attack was a computer network attack that may have been perpetrated by one or more state parties against a nuclear plant in Iran. It really illustrates kind of the toughest case of classifying an armed conflict involving a cyber attack. We see a situation where there's not a pre-existing armed conflict, where the attribution, although many believe it's clear, it's not been claimed. And we're looking at whether this would rise to the level of an attack within the meaning of the law governing when an armed conflict begins. There's not widespread agreement on that yet. It'll remain to be seen in the practice of states whether this type of cyber attack becomes considered a triggering act for the existence of an armed conflict. Outside of a pre-existing armed conflict, I think the law is still a little bit unclear and there needs to be more discussion about the interpretation.
So, with the likelihood of these types of attacks increasing, what do we know about what a legal case would look like that tried to bring people or state actors or non-state entities to account for such an event?
It could look like a domestic case under the national laws of an affected state. It could look like a case at the international level, although I think at this stage it would have to be a crime that was predefined. So you'd have to find that it was, for example, a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions.
That's Ellen Policinski, a leading global expert on the laws of war from the ICRC. She's also managing editor of the International Review of the Red Cross. You can find out more information on our homepage about the War in Cities conference that Ellen is speaking at this week in Melbourne. That's it for the Law Report. Producer Anita Barrow works tirelessly behind the scenes and the program would be lost without her, so big thanks to her. And thanks also to our sound engineer, John Jacobs. I'm Erica Vowles. Catch you next time on the Law Report.